Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires we call the internets is Joe Crazy Writer. How you doing today, Joe?
I'm doing Hang on a second.
Hey, you stupid Iowans! Quiet down here! I don't care if you're caucusing for president. We're trying to do a podcast here. We can't be listening to you. If you ain't voting for Bernie, I don't want to hear about it. Shut up! Close the door! Jeez! I'm telling you, Mississippi flows south because Iowa sucks. Okay, I'm back.
So that's how you're doing, huh?
It's just so loud all of a sudden. What the heck? And you're closer to him than I am.
We don't get into a lot of politics on the show, but I would like to remind people that the Iowa caucus means nothing.
Nothing. Although, what does mean something?
Yes?
Happy birthday, Image Comics.
24 years.
Can you believe it? That alone would take an entire podcast to talk about how on February 1st, 1992, a press release was sent out announcing the formation of Image Comic. And the details of who did exactly what was a bit vague, conflicting reports, blah, blah, blah. But once the smoke settled, the founders of Image Comics would be Todd McFarlane, Rob Liefeld, Jim Lee, Eric Larson, Mark Silvestri, Jim Valentino, and Wilsh Potashio joined a little later. And
he was supposed to be one of the founders, but the story at the time was that he had a family issue to deal with.
Chris Claremont was also listed in the initial press release, but
alerts.
He had been planning to team with Potashio on a new title called Huntsman, but Claremont went on to DC.
And he really didn't do, when you think of Chris Claremont's run at DC, you really don't think of anything that stands out. He had the creator-owned book that was in the DC Universe, Sovereign 7, that just kind of sat there.
Yeah.
And no one seemed to care.
And when he went back to Marvel, everybody thought, oh, maybe he'll bring it back to Marvel, but it just kind of disappeared. I do remember meeting him at one of Cap City's shows, and he took great pains into getting all the retailers' business cards, but nothing ever came of it as far as I know, unless he just likes collecting business cards.
One of the things I've heard about Chris Claremont is that he is a guy who could have been, you remember how the Image guys were uber rock stars.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because Spider-Man had, with McFarlane, did what, $2.5 million? X-Force 1 with Rob Liefeld did 5 million copies. And then two months after that, Jim Lee on X-Men number 1, 8.1 million.
I thought it was 9 when all the dust
settled. It might have been.
But Claremont, through the 80s, you know, the X-Men, it's hard for us to understand how big the X-Men was in the 80s because there was just the one book, and then you had New Mutants, and then eventually you had X-Factor. They didn't expand it a lot. But if anybody had the, you know, could have been called a rock star in comics, it was Claremont. And I never heard a story about him, you know, with a big head or being a jerk to fans, unlike some other of his people he worked with.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I find interesting was there for a while when he came back to Marvel, he wasn't just a writer. He was also kind of a story consultant and had kind of an editorial role. And that seems to have faded out. The last book that I remember him doing was the Nightcrawler series that lasted 12 issues that I really enjoyed, but it just didn't seem to catch fire.
Nope. However, and Image is still catching fire to these days.
Image I find fascinating because it started as we're going to be, you know, creator owned, you know, da 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 da. And it wasn't long before it was, no, it really wasn't. It was studios, and the studios created these superhero books, and they tried to have a shared universe, but it didn't really work. And when the early 90s superhero boom died, there was times when Image was in serious trouble of losing their kind of special status with distributors, which is why they started taking on other creator-owned books in order to keep their overall sales numbers at a point so they could stay at the front of the catalog. And they eventually have merged into what they are now, which is kind of where comic creators go to do creator-owned work. You don't see a lot of creator-owned stuff at other publishers, really. Image is where you go if that's what you want to do. And if you would have told me 24 years ago that Image was going to be my favorite publisher, I would have beat you with a case of Youngblood number one.
Do you want to go into our special review now, since we've been talking Image?
Sure.
All right.
This comic is from Image.
Yes.
We were given the trade paperback to review called Starve by Brian Wood. And let me pull up the artist.
Oh, never mind. I got it right here. It's Daniel.
Oh, you do?
I can't even pronounce it. Z-E-Z-E-L-J. Good luck with that one.
The first thing that hit me when I read it was it very much sticks to a lot of the stuff Brian Wood does. It's set in the near future. It's there's been an environmental collapse, and there's a huge class gap where, you know, now we have the rich and the poor, but after the environmental collapse, it's the ultra rich, and then everybody else has nothing. Which is what he did for DMZ, it's what he did for The Massive, it's what he's doing for the sequel to The Massive. It's kind of the arena he likes to play in.
I'll read the synopsis off of Atomic Avenue here for Star, and once again, it's got a name that I'm just going to gut. But once the world's most famous chef, Gavin Cruikshank, does that sound good?
That's good enough.
He's been in a self-imposed exile for years. His little foodie program has since evolved into Starve, an arena sport that pits chef against chef for the pleasure of their super-rich patrons. It's a stain on the once noble profession, and Chef Kelvin is ready to go to war to stop it. Two things stand in his way: his arch rival, Roman Algiers, and his daughter, who's now an adult, Angie. Probably just wants her dad back and acting normal. Having read this, I don't necessarily agree with that synopsis, all of it, but by the time I finished reading issue number one, you know, like most of the time you start these books, you don't know what's going on, but by the time I got to the end of number one, the story progressed enough and there was enough hint of what had happened before that you catch along very quickly.
I was hooked immediately. I fell completely in love with this comic. The main character has flaws, but he's not unlikable. The situation is it's kind of played out slowly. The lead character is the one who brings us into the story, lets us know what this world is like, sets up the stakes. And it, like
steak?
A lot of good...
Did you say steak? We're having steak.
Like a lot of good social satire, it takes stuff that's going on now and just blows it up. You know, if you watch Food Network now, it's all food competitions.
That's all I watch. My daughters absolutely love it.
But this takes it up to a higher level where the food competition is more, all right, in this episode, you don't just have to make bluefin tuna. Bluefin tuna is extinct, probably. You need to find it and cook it. Or, you know, you need to make barbecue, but to make it, you have to fight the other chefs to get into their kitchen and make the barbecue. The art is beautiful.
Yes. Like I talk about, it's very stylish, which is to be expected these days. I guess the days of clean art like Byrne and Perez is over. But it's not wild enough where you cannot follow who's who. All the characters have a distinct look. So I'm not constantly going back to figure out in a word balloon, okay, who is this? Did they say the person's name? You know it just by turning the page. You know who you're looking at. And it's not a huge cast of characters, so you're not totally screwed up trying to figure out who's who.
And the other thing about the art is the color. They use a limited palette for each section of the story. so it feels very muted, and it the color actually heightens the emotion that you're feeling on the page. My second time reading through it, I noticed that, you know, the pages with his daughter are colored this way. The pages with his ex-wife, who is feuding with him, are colored this way. The kitchen battles are colored this way. The first trade paperback is the first five issues. It doesn't end on a cliffhanger, but it doesn't complete the story.
Now, the good thing is, if you want to find the first five issues in comic book format, they are fairly inexpensive on eBay or Atomic Avenue. Should be able to put together a set for maybe less than what the book one costs through Image. I mean, they're doing like they do with all their book ones. It's $9.99, so if you want to jump on board. The reason we mention that is because issue number 6, or as he calls it, season 2, starts this February. Actually, probably, if you excuse me while I look at the calendar, about a week from when this podcast will drop. February 16th, I believe he said the next issue is due.
And I'm hooked. I'm hooked on this comic. I'm a big Brian Wood fan. Oddly enough, his work at Marvel never really excited me, but his solo stuff and his stuff over at Vertigo, I always liked it because it was more to it than just an action adventure. It was more to it than just, you know, characters interacting. He would put in social commentary. He liked dealing with this sort of dystopian future, such taking the environmental issues we have now, playing them out, and then how would that affect the people who are still alive? Joe, on this one, buy, borrow, or ignore?
Oh, I'd say buy. Matter of fact, I'm going to buy it, and, you know, I'm always battling to try to get my wife to read something. I'm going to see if she's interested. I was explaining this to her. She was kind of looking over my shoulder as I was reading it. I definitely know my other two daughters will enjoy it because, like I said, my whole family loves cooking shows and that. I think this will be right up their alley. Corey, what do you think?
I've given it a big buy it. I don't think you need to be a fan of cooking shows or cooking battles because it really sucks you in. And the fact that he gives the little recipes struck me a lot like the Kurt Vonnegut book, Dead Eye Dick, where outside of the story, if the character cooks something, Vonnegut would write, oh, here's the recipe for what he's cooking. And I always find that kind of an interesting thing that an author can do to give a story a little more realism, a little more grounding.
But if you do have friends that are big into cooking shows, give them this.
Yep. This may be the best, quote, cooking comic I have read before, because there was Iron Walk Jan, which was a manga that was basically Iron Chef knockoff. Anthony Bourdain did a comic that I've tried reading a couple of times, and I lose interest about 20, 30 pages in. But this one had me hooked, and I can't wait to read the whole thing. And I'm kind of wondering if this is another one of those where they say it's a series, but really he's got it planned for like 30, 40, 50 issues, something like that.
Well, if he takes
a
pause in between certain spots, maybe, you know, you almost think he does, I hope.
Well, and one of the things that's happening as the show's getting a little bigger, but I'm getting smaller, is that we are having people contact us about projects they're doing. And one of those projects is from a man named King Chan, who's got a Kickstarter where he is trying to start a new comic distribution business. And I sat down with him and talked with him for a little while. Right here was supposed to be an interview with a gentleman named King Chan. He gave me about 15 minutes of his time. We talked over the project he's doing, and I'd like to let you know about the project, at least. And it's called Comics Underground Distribution. So if you go to Kickstarter and put in Comics Underground Distribution Catalog by King Chan, what he's doing, he is creating an independent comic book creators catalog. Sort of doing a Kickstarter to print this catalog to send it to every comic book shop in America that he's able to find. And the way it started was he was doing a comic that was rejected by Diamond, and rather than just kind of give up, he decided he would create his own comics distribution network. I asked a number of questions about what the barriers are to get in, how he's going to do it, and most of them are explained in this Kickstarter. But to paraphrase it, it's if you're an independent comics creator and you're willing to publish a book, he's willing to distribute it. So you would just contact him through the Kickstarter, let him know about the book you're publishing. He's not able to get the people who are under exclusive contracts with Diamond, but as this project goes on, he's looking to bring in the people who aren't exclusive with Diamond, maybe offer them better terms, and hopefully build an alternative to Diamond for the comics creators who maybe aren't as mainstream as the stuff Diamond puts out. So it's over at Kickstarter. Just put in King Chan, K-I-N-G-C-H-A-N, and his project is the Comics Underground Distribution Catalog. As this goes up, there will be 7 days to go. So go ahead, and I want to apologize to him for the fact that the recording turned out poorly. We just couldn't use it on the show. So hopefully this gives an idea of what he's up to and answers some of the questions. And what I wanted to talk about in this episode with distribution. First, what he wants to do is have distribution for very small press publishers. Joe, as a retailer, what would it have taken in your small shop for you get a new catalog from a new distributor? What would it take for you to place an order?
You mean like Crazy as opposed to Hot Comics?
Yeah.
I don't know, $20,000 hooker maybe? Hey, if it's good enough for what's-his-name in New York, I mean, as a small comic retailer, I'd be very hard-pressed to bring in books. The best thing you could probably do is give me a sampler. You know, what was the book we talked about last episode?
There was Andre the Giant and then
Octo, that type of thing. That would be the type of thing you would want to do. Whereas Octal is more designed to try to entice a publisher or a producer into, say, yeah, this is a great idea, here's some money, go ahead and make your comic. If he has these comics and he can give me a sampler catalog showing me what it is he's offering me. If he's very small, I'm not expecting an actual comic book, although that would help. But you're really going to have to show me what you're doing, not just tell me. Because a lot of people tell me stuff. I react more to the art, you know. Samples would definitely get my attention. At Hot Comics, because I was so bloody big, I probably would have just ordered onesie twosies to begin with. Maybe, again, have the catalog out so my customers can look at it. See if I actually know a couple people, you know, that I knew during Hot Comics that would have bought the line, you know, especially because they're zombie fans and things like that. They probably would have bought that. Otherwise, you know, I was more prone to support small press, especially if it was local. I mean, if you had a local guy that you were publishing, I probably would have ordered it just to help him out. But it's going to be a tough road to battle. I mean, last episode, we were really down on Marvel DC. I think it was last episode, wasn't it? Might have been a couple. We've been kind of down on DC for a while, but Marvel's been joining it. So if we're giving grief to the big boys, you know, a smaller guy starting out, I mean, he's not just starting out as a publisher. He's starting out as a distributor. You know, you might want to just get your own book out and running before you start taking in other people's properties. I'd also be curious on what his terms would be. Is he doing it like a broker, the way Diamond kind of does Marvel and Diamond? They just take a little piece of it. They don't actually get it. Or are you going to do it like Cap City and Diamond did for other people? It'd be like, okay, I'm going to say, what was a book? Like $4. Therefore, if I give 40% discount to the retailer, and you got to figure how much percentage it costs to make as a distributor. What's a distributor markup anyways? Like 5%, 10%?
I don't know. Diamond has been very Diamond doesn't have to tell anybody anything, so they don't.
Well, considering they've blown out books for as little as 35 cents, they must be pretty thin in order for them, because, you know, they're not making a lot of money from brokering the big boys. It could be why a lot of times we didn't see, you know, when they had Small Press Publisher number one, I only used to get a 35% discount from them. In which case, I would go to places like Cold Cut and buy it through them, because they oftentimes gave a better discount than Diamond would. Now, things have changed a lot since I've had the shop. I mean, I know now that a lot of comics won't be picked up by Diamond because they don't reach a certain threshold. I believe that's how what happened with Arsenic Lullaby. His whole thing stopped because he wasn't selling enough. And, you know, I don't know what happened with Diamond's Blessing. He went on to do it himself with Kickstarter, con appearances, things like that. A lot of smaller guys have to do it that way because they might never get into Diamond catalog. I don't even know which... Are there any smaller comic distributors around? I mean, there's a lot of people doing it online. I mean, Comic X and things like that where you can digitally upload your comic. But are there actual places that a retailer could go to buy the physical comic anymore?
I don't think there are. I know that Cold Cut used to do it when you had the smaller shop.
A Rip-Off
but they...
Press did it. They might still do it, but only for their titles. Kitchen
well,
Sink.
Well, another... Kitchen Sink's gone.
Yeah. Everybody that I would have bought from... There was a small distributor that opened up in town here. This was after Cap City moved out, and we were buying stuff from Diamond. And they were really, really close to the source. I would drive over, and he had walls of graphic novels, walls of comics, some supplies. But at the time, you remember, DC, Dark Horse, Image, Diamond, there's probably more of that. I mean, you're talking the big boys. They were all exclusive, either with Advance Comics through Cap City or previews with Diamond Comics. So, I mean, I would go over and I'd buy what I could. You know, I could buy Cerebus from anywhere. I could buy manga, which was slowly starting to rise. He didn't last long, though. I mean, he sold out, and I'll be damned if I can remember who he sold out for to. But, I mean, he was a local guy. It was cool because I could go to the store, pick up what I needed. Again, I don't think he lasted more than a couple years.
I think that's the big barrier that new distributors are going to have, and that is they're not going to be able to say, we've got this thing that you are already selling or you already need that you can't get from Diamond, or we can compete with Diamond. The gentleman I interviewed, he's going to be working with a lot of small press publishers who haven't been able to get into Diamond, but one of the things to get into Diamond's catalog, they have to look at your stuff and say, well, we think we can move 2,000 to 3,000 copies of this, which means you're going to be working with lower numbers. You've also got to get known in stores, and, you know, sending somebody a catalog is great, but Joe, how many catalogs did you get? And I'm not talking comics, but at Hot Comics, how many catalogs did you get a month?
Oh, I got all sorts of stuff. You know, and a lot of times it was things that, you know, like I remember I got a catalog for calendars, and they were on a returnable basis. And we toyed with the idea we could get all these calendars in, you get them in about August for the next year. In February, you return them, what you didn't sell, and then you have a credit going forward to the next year. The only problem was is the minimum was, I forget what it was, like $500 or $1,000. Which was a lot of money to sink in with the promise that you would only get a $500 credit, assuming I didn't even sell a single calendar. It was that or buy them through Diamond, non-returnable. And I still got calendars in my pile of stuff from the years I had a comic store where I actually took a chance, bought one, or somebody bought it, and ordered it, and never picked it up. So it's, you know, and then there were other things too. I mean, you and I remember trying to talk about doing DVDs and tapes and maybe setting up a rental thing. And there were just, but when the, when it came down to it, you know, it was just me. I didn't have time to do it all. I had a full-time job just trying to keep, you know, Heroes World, Cap City, Diamond. And then when Heroes World went under, or was it Advanced Comics went under first? And eventually it just all became
Cap City went under,
and then Heroes World
went away.
And then I was all into Diamond. I mean, it's still even with just Diamond. And I'm sure Diamond had a tough time, too. They faced a lot of criticism by the fact that there were books they could not afford to carry for whatever their market plan is. Like you said, about 3,000. In other words, if you sold under 3,000 copies through Diamond, they lost money carrying you. Because I believe they bought the books, sat it on their bookshelf in their warehouse, filled pre-orders, and if there was any left over, left them there hoping they would have reorders. And if, I don't know what would happen if product just became stale. Diamond had a wonderful liquidation catalog that came out every week where they would just, they might have onesie twosies of certain products and just blow it out. But there were also comics that, oh, I just wanted no part of, even at 35 cents.
Well, and look at Discount Comic Book Service. You could go to their website right now. You want all of the Convergence books? They've got them there 80% off.
Month after month, 80% off.
And there's a couple websites out there that sell remaindered graphic novels. Some of those things have been on that website for 10 years. And people just, I don't want it, don't need it, don't care.
Can I make a confession?
Why, yes, you can.
I told you my story of my copy of Fish Police number one.
Yes.
And how I paid $35 for it.
Yes.
That's because he said it was the last one. And then, of course, my old partner, Pat Gruber, came in the next day and bought his for $35.
Yes.
And it's not like worth, what, a quarter?
I don't know.
Hard,
I don't even know.
Hard pressed to give me a quarter for it. I bought Convergence in the half price deal that Discount Comic Book Service offered. Both halves. I mean, and I've enjoyed reading them, but the thought that I could have buy them now at 35 cents a pop, I no longer feel bad about Fish Police number one.
Now, there was a time, I know when I worked at Shinders, Shinders used two distributors. They used Cap Cities because Cap Cities had a warehouse.
And they bent over backwards
in Minneapolis.
For Shinders.
Oh, yeah. And then when
I told you,
you
once,
started getting
when
stuff.
People asked about Diamond Comics and what it would take for them to break into our market, we told them, well, you need to have a warehouse here. And they told most of the retailers that will never happen because we can't get Shinders to buy from us.
Right.
And there was no reason for them to do that. We did order through Diamond.
But Shinders would also order from Rip Off Press because Shinders made good money off Underground Books. We had a complete run of Zap available pretty much the whole time I worked there. Any of the Undergrounds that were in print, we would have, and we would either put them with the High Times magazine, which I still think is the dumbest magazine ever printed, or in the porn room. And I actually, when I worked at Shinders, is when I got most of my Underground comics, because all the Fab Furry Freak Brothers were still in print. A lot of Crumb was still in print. A lot of Kitchen Sink was still in print. Zap was all in print. I have a complete run of Zap up until 92. Because they kept it in print. And Shinders would order from them. But I do remember the big fight that Diamond had with Dave Sim over Cerebus.
Mm-hmm.
But Cerebus sold so well, they wouldn't cut
Cerebus.
Yeah,
that's because Cerebus, he was doing the phone books. And where he reprinted, you know, 25, 30 issues of his book. but he was not initially soliciting them through comic distribution. So Diamond decided, well, if you're not going to do that, we're not going to carry Puma Blues, which was a small comic being published by Sim at the time.
Which is also kind of like saying, oh, you're not going to sell, you're going to sell pizza in other places? Fine, I'm going to buy baked ham from the, we're not going to buy baked ham from you anymore. Doesn't make any sense.
No, just ask Oprah. It just doesn't make sense.
Yes, you could get away with that joke today, can't you?
Well, it's a different form of the same joke. Plus, I let it rest for half a dozen podcasts. So.
Okay. But then when I worked with you, there was a while when I would come over on Wednesdays and I would pick up your books. Was it Wednesdays or I don't remember. But I would go to the warehouse, and the Cap City warehouse was, you know, this dinky little place in St. Paul. But you'd go in and he would just have stacks of stuff on the shelf, and you would give me a list. If he's got this, 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 and this, pick it up.
Which was kind of cool because you'd be picking it up and getting it before most of the other retailers in town would. So that was kind of a cool angle.
But you could also pick up supplies, boxes, trade paperbacks that have been out for a while. I remember, you know, he would have, oh, here's all the DC archives. Do you guys need any of them? Here's all the Sandman. Are you guys out of any Sandman-ish trades? It was good to have a distributor in town. And while Diamond could be the best in the world, it's still not the same as being able to drive to the warehouse and pick up stuff.
Well, and you could also do other things, too. You could drop off your order form, you could call him up and say, hey, I need this. You could give him the check so you weren't mailing things. When Diamond, well, I shouldn't say Diamond, but when the Distributors Wars broke open, suddenly you had a deal where, okay, I have to buy Marvel Comics through Heroes World. I have to buy DC and Image through Diamond. And I can buy Dark Horse, Top Cow, and almost all the other independents through Cap City. But I also had to kind of watch because sometimes it'd be one independent that would only be in Diamond, one Diamond independent that would only be in Cap City. The local warehouses closed, and this was probably the number one thing that affected comic retailers. All of a sudden, we were hit with shipping charges. Because when we used to pick up stuff at the warehouse, we weren't paying shipping charges. I'm sure Cap City was incurring them. But they would come up from Madison, stop at Eclair, stop at, what was the name of that? Oh, in St. Paul, and then continue on into North Dakota. They might have even stopped at Granite City. I don't remember. But now we suddenly are getting these $100 a week shipping charges. Even if we picked up the books, for a while there, Cap said, well, you know what, we'll meet at this parking lot across the street from where the distribution center used to be, and you can pick up your books. And most of us had terms, so we didn't have to, like, give them a check right away. But you're still paying the shipping charges, so you might as well, just ship it to me. And then it got to the point where you were like, you know what, it's not. Some people just totally abandoned Cap City and just went with Diamond because they were like, well, I might as well just go with these guys because I can get everything through them. I don't know if the other Hot Comics did that. Me, I was still kind of trying to support the little guys. So I was like, you know what, I'm going to stick with Cap City because I supported them. And eventually it all just wound up. Eventually, you know, it was a big cost, and it really cut into profits. Although once finally Diamond did take over everything, they were a very good steward to the comic industry because they weren't stupid. They knew they didn't want to hurt us because that would take them down too. And they basically absorbed Cap City and took care of the outstanding debt and then did the same thing with Heroes World. So, you know, I people talk bad about Diamond Comics, but they did help keep the direct market going.
And the other thing about Diamond that everyone was worried about was, oh, well, now that they run everything, they could determine what sells and what doesn't. And Diamond kind of had a history of not really wanting to sell adult-themed comics. And being a – they were kind of the distributor that would if you had too much violence or too much nudity or you know, outright sex, we'd go, we're not going to carry that comic. I remember at the time Fantagraphics was actually quite concerned and were doing a lot of articles in the Comics Journal. But once Diamond became the only game in town, for better or worse, that seems to have gone away, and all they really care about now is, does it look professional, and do we think it will get enough sales? I do think there's room for someone to work with the indie books, and Cold Cut Distribution did that for you for a long time.
Oh, yeah, I loved Cold Cut, and what was nice is if there was an independent book and they kept it in print, I could usually order it direct from them, and a lot of times they would have it in stock, whereas Diamond might not, and they would give me pretty decent terms, so I wouldn't be ordering at 35%. I might be ordering upwards of 40, sometimes upwards of 50, depending on what it was. So I was able to go through and place fairly big orders. If you came into my store looking for a copy of, say, Colleen Doran's Distant Soil, I had them all. She actually visited my store. I had quite a number of them autographed by her. So, and that was something I always tried to do. If it was in stock, I tried to make sure I at least had one or two copies of it. And if you went through the back issues, not everything was on the shelf, but I did have a number of boxes that I knew, but these are independent comics at cover price. I didn't bag and board them, but we just let them go. And then once a month, twice a month, if sales were slow, I'd go through, figure out which holes I had, and just fill them. And then I'd look at other things that Diamond had. Well, not Diamond, Cold Cut. And try to just fill holes or see what I could, what kind of business I could toss their way. So, I used Cold Cut quite a bit. And, you wonder if it actually made a difference. I bring up the fact that in one of the Staros reports, we did it for 2 years. Talking about the state of independent comic industry, they actually listed my store as being independent comic friendly. So somebody noticed.
And Chris Staros, who did the Staros report, is now in charge of Top Shelf Publishing,
which is now an imprint of IDW.
Yep.
Which is where our good buddy Alan Payne left. Al Payne's been a friend of ours for years.
He was involved in the founding of the Minnesota Comic Book Convention,
which is having their MSP Comic Con 2016, May 14th and 15th, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Saturday, and 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Sunday at the Minnesota State Fairgrounds. If you haven't already, jump over to www.mcbacomiccons.com because they got advanced tickets going, and you can pick them up right now. We're going to be there. It's going to be the last ever charity booth slash rummage sale. My daughters are probably going to be running it because Corey and I are going to be set up as the official, unofficial podcasters. Or is that the unofficial, official podcasters of the MCBA? And if you're a guest or you got something you want to say, stop by and we'll give you a quick interview. We'll be hunting people down. So remember, May 14th and 15th, 2016.
And Joe?
Oh, I didn't.
There's going to be a big announcement.
Ooh.
At SpringCon for the Solitaire Rose Network. Yes, we will have a huge announcement. Monstrous. It's something that we have not done at the network before. Something is coming this November.
Is Alan Payne going to be your vice president of sales and marketing?
No.
That's because he got hired on at Dynamite Entertainment.
Oh,
yeah, that's why I brought it. See, I'm bringing that all thing around thing. Because Alan,
bringing it back.
Alan began his career at Dreamhaven Books, owned by that damn fine, handsome man, Greg Ketter. In the early
Dreamhaven's 90s. Still around, by the way.
And he moved, Alan that is, to California to work at Malibu Comics. He got hired on as National Accounts Manager in 2006 at Tokyo Pop. And as we just mentioned, finished 9 years at IDW. And now he was VP of sales there. And now, of course, he's at Dynamite Entertainment as their Vice President of Sales and Marketing. So we give a big kudos to Alan. And, of course, I have no idea if he listens to this here podcast, but we'll be hitting him up for see if we can't get on a few review lists or something.
Damn right we should.
Oh, yeah. Al's our connection. I mean, I buy enough Dynamite comics. He owes me. Yeah, it's just the attitude to take. You owe me, Payne.
You owe me, buddy.
No, Al was a great guy. I used to love going into Dreamhaven Books because I'd come in and, you know, I'd pick up. At the time, I was bought most of my comics at St. Paul Comics, again, using Advanced Comics. And I'd walk in and, you know, just talk with Al. He was kind of like the Sam Malone of Cheers, you know, he's just happy to see you. And then I'd always ask him, what should I check out? What would be cool? And he'd show me some of the things on, he'd think a minute, show me some cool things off the shelf. So very attuned to the comic industry. I did ask him, though, if he's going to bring back the imprint that him and Paul Ewert did, the Entropy Tales. I believe Greg Ketter. He said, if you will indulge me a moment while I, no. Entropy Tales, by the way, is probably best known because that's where Pete Krause started his career. He's currently working Insatiable with Mark Waid for Boom, I believe, isn't it?
And you know who? What else? What other comic was published by the same publishing group? Do you remember?
Oh, Tales from the Heart.
Tales from the Heart, which was the story of a Peace Corps volunteer in Africa, which after it got picked up a couple places and was actually had a couple of issues published by Epic.
Mm-hmm.
And then the writer left the comic business, which I was very sad about because I really loved that book. It was one of those autobiographical books. The early 90s, there were a lot of autobiographical comics, but it was different because a lot of the autobiographical comics of the early 90s were, you know, so, an artist who would spend their time going, oh, I'm a miserable bastard, and here are all the horrible things that I do. I'm looking at you, Joe Matt.
Yeah.
I'm looking at you, Seth. I'm looking at you, Chester Brown. I'm looking at you, R. Crumb.
Wait, Chester Brown, didn't he live in a shoe?
No.
Chester Brown, I live in a shoe. Here's my dog, Spamalot. He lived in there, too.
I'm about to give a little bit of Corey's secret pass, by
Ooh.
The way, Joe.
Hang on. I got to sit down and have a drink. Let's go.
All right. Tales from the Heart did actually fairly well. I think I should look. I'm pretty sure it got picked up by Kimiko. And then when Kimiko went on it, it went over to Image. But it was kind of this bubbling underground. It was successful enough. And when I first moved to Minnesota, I had gone through the massive collapse that was Solson, which I don't know if I've told that story on the air, but I was actually hired as a writer for Solson. I wrote over 40 comics. Not a one got published, and I never got paid. So I was still pretty stung by that, but it's okay. Yeah, I graduated college. I'm here in Minnesota. I'm married. I got a kid, but I still got to write. I wrote up a pitch for a comic based on what I was doing at the group home because I had just started work at a group home in the juvenile justice field. And I fictionalized it. And I wrote up, okay, here's what the first 12 issues will be. Here's the overarching storyline, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I sent it to Kimiko because Kimiko was publishing Tales from the Heart. And I thought, well, if they're friendly to that, they'll be friendly to this. And Kimiko said, this is great. We want this. Write up full scripts. See if you can find an artist. We had just started the convention here. So it's, yeah, I could probably figure out, talk to somebody about an artist and everything. And I'm writing it up and writing it up. And I send in the first two scripts and I get back a very nice letter from Kimiko that says they're going under. But they give me the address and contact information for someone at Kitchen Sink, Dennis Kitchen, who might be interested. Send it to Dennis Kitchen. Same thing. Wow, this is a cool idea. Too bad we're not going to be publishing any new books.
Corey, the death knell of comic companies.
Oh, there for a while, I honestly felt like I was killing companies. Because there's a short story I have in one comic called Pyramid Tales, where they liked my writing, but they didn't have room for it. So they told me, write a text short story. And then once we get room, we'll take this idea you have and we'll turn it into a comic. Great. They went under.
Yeah.
Solson, I was going to be the next writer of Reagan's Raiders. I don't know if I should be proud of that or not. But they started Reagan's Raiders, which I don't know if anybody remembers Reagan's Raiders.
Oh,
do you remember
I do.
Reagan's Raiders?
Yes, I do.
It was the Ronald Reagan and his cabinet cloned fighting commies.
Let's see, Reagan's Raiders from Solston from 86 to 87, three issues available.
Yes. Oh, my God, it's terrible. It's so
but
goddamn
terrible. He's wearing the flag. It's got the flag. For those of you that collect flag covers, you've got to find these.
But they had started it with Reagan being popular, and then Iran Contra hit, and they were like, oh, holy shit.
Dick,
what do we do
Dick
now?
Dick Ayers was there. Rick Buckler
yes.
was there.
You know why?
No.
It was called Solson. It was Sol Brodsky's son.
Ah.
Sol Brodsky, who had worked at Timely and Atlas and Marvel. Then he went over to Atlas when Atlas Seaboard started, and then he came back to Marvel. And he worked in production, and he retired, and his son wanted to get into comics, so he thought he'd publish his own stuff. All of their ideas were terrible. Chainsaw Santa, they were all terrible, but I didn't care. Oh, it's a foot in. And so I had sent in an idea, and they said, we like this idea, but we've got our own stuff. So what we'll do, and they actually sent me a contract. You write two of our books that we own, and we'll publish two of yours that you would own. I'm 22, about to graduate from college. Joe, can you imagine how happy I was? It was like, this is the greatest thing ever. And Rich Buckler will be my editor. Holy shit. And I was given Iron Maidens, which were four bodybuilding women who were also detectives. Remember what I said about these stories being
yes.
terrible?
Oh.
And I worked it into something, and they really liked it. So they sent me information on Reagan's Raiders, and they said, look, Reagan's popularity is falling apart, and this Iran-Contra thing, the current writer has no clue what to do. If you can think of something, let us know. And I was much more politically loud than I am now. I wrote a story about them trying – basically, it was they were trying to fix the mistakes the Reagan administration had made and kept making it worse because the more you meddle, the worse it gets. And it was, you know, I had all the political stuff in El Salvador in it and all this other stuff. And I don't have any of it now. But I just remember at the time going, this is good. And I bet if I read it now, I'd go, Jesus God, what a piece of shit.
Just for the record, Tales from the Heart, two issues came through Entropy Tales. Issues 3 through 11 were through Slave Labor. They also did two books. And then there was that epic one-shot in 1980.
That's right. Kimiko accepted it, and when they went under, that went over to Epic.
Yeah.
So I understand it. Okay.
So I think they're worth picking up. They're you know, cheap. Find them.
Yeah, they're really good. But Rich Buckler was like, I can't believe it. You've saved this book. And it was, this is great. This is so great.
And then?
And then I graduated college, so I'm already, you know, I've graduated college. The job I had, working at the college movie theater and a couple other things around the university, you could only do if you're a student. So it was okay. I'm set. And then Rich Buckler quit returning my calls. And the checks that were supposed to show up weren't showing up. And I remember there was one time where I was out of money. I had to walk uptown to use a payphone to call to try and say, what the hell is going on? And I called the number, and a woman picked up, and I said, is Rich Buckler there? I have no idea who you're calling. and my heart just kind of stopped beating. And it was, oh, shit. The good thing is, if that would have turned into something, I wouldn't have moved to Minnesota, Joe.
That's true, and then no one could listen to this here podly goodness.
That's right. You know who else exists just because of me moving here and making friends with Joe?
Who's that?
These guys, our sponsors.
Believe it or not, kids, this silliness has actual real sponsors. Our first sponsor is Graze.com. Graze gives you healthy snacks sent to your house. You can have them delivered weekly, bi-weekly, monthly, and your first box is free if you use the code CORYS3R5B. Our second sponsor is Bombas. Bombas socks are some of the best socks in the world, and remember, for every pair you buy, they donate a pair to a homeless shelter or other worthy cause. Just go to bombas.gotocloud.org/SF30. That's right. Those are our ads. Go check out our sponsors.
And now that the sponsors are over, Joe, what the hell is going on with eBay?
All right. Well, I had so much fun the last couple of weeks just throwing out titles that I sold on eBay. I think I'm going to continue it, and we're going to call it Continue the Ask the Strode.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right. So we'll take a few moments as I prime the thinking grenades and Corey gets his cap on.
I will sit in the thinking chair.
Oh, is that what you call it? I thought it was your bathroom.
By the way, I'm looking at the Iowa caucus results, Joe.
Oh.
Martin O'Malley has 0.5% of the vote.
Oh, man. I'm going to have to run down there and help him as soon as we're done here.
Jeb Bush has 2.79% of the vote.
Are you saying this for historical posterity, so when people go through these old podcasts, they can talk about what was going on?
Here's the other thing. On the Republican side, other, 0.08%. Jim Gilmore, 0.01%.
See, felt bad because...
You should probably tap
out. I felt bad because our one of our fans, John Davis, you know, as I go through Facebook, they cough up these, do you remember this? See your memories? And I put up an episode, which happened to be Crazy Comics and Stories 95, and he went in there. John was it took me away in an inauguration, and then I saw the year and the number, because that was way back in 2013. I was then in D.C. working the inauguration. So, and then of course not more than an hour later, you popped the last week's episode on. So, sorry, John.
So ask the Strode. I'm ready.
Corey,
here we go.
Tell me about Trapman. It was a local comic.
Didn't it come with a cassette tape?
You could order that version if you wanted.
I remember you had it in the shop, and it had a radio play version of the comic.
Yep.
And you had it on your shelf for at least 3 years.
And I just sold it.
Whoa!
Yep. Trap Man is a comic. It was done by Peter J. Milley. Paul Fricke did the art. Gordon Purcell did the cover. It's a buck at best on eBay. What was interesting, as we said, I mean, I had this thing. Oh, when did it come out? Does it say here? 1994 is when it came out. I don't know where I must have met him at the con. On the back of the comic, it says it was going to be a 12-part story. You could order merchandise. You could pre-order issue 2. You could order the said radio play on the cassette. Only issue 1 came out, and it disappeared. I don't know what happened to anybody. I mean, obviously, Paul Fricke, Gordon Purcell are around. I haven't heard if Peter Milley, if he's around. I had heard he kind of was a little brash to some of the other creators at the con, you know, in asking him if they would want to join in and do a cover for him and we'll make some money and blah, blah, blah. And I don't know who he was talking to, but whoever it was took a little umbrage at that. But if he's a listener or if anybody else knows, I'd be curious what happened, because obviously this came out with the best intentions. He did issue 1. He did the tape. I sold it with the tape sealed, so I never did listen to it. I'd be curious as to why only one issue came out. What happened?
Joe, how many did you have in your shop?
I don't recall, because remember, I sold most of my back issues when I actually sold the store. So, you know, but being an independent like that and a local guy, probably 10 sounds like I probably would just order a direct from him and maybe picked up one or two of the tape just for the heck of it.
I just remember you had it on the shelf the whole time you owned the store.
Oh, yeah. And I think I kept the tape one with the intention on listening to it, but after Miami Mice, it kind of soured my experience. Corey,
yes.
Tell me about The Wild. Not The Wild from MU Press, 2004 to 2005, an adult black and white comic. Not The Wild from Marvel, 1954, some type of funny type book. But The Wild from Unleashed 2000.
Could you please spell the book?
W-I-L-D.
Okay, so not W-Y-L-D.
Negative.
I do not know Wild from Unleashed. I do think that there was a comic spelled W-Y-L-D. And I'm actually going to look that up while you tell us about The Wild from Unleashed. Was Unleashed the one that said, we will never publish more than 250,000 copies of our books?
No friggin' clue, because I bought this one. It was a signed, limited collector edition, sealed, never opened it, never looked at it, just sold it. Might have sold it for a buck. I might have sold it for a buck with free shipping. All I know is I sold it.
All right, Wild, W-Y-L-D, was actually a character in the Teen Titans and seems to be the son of Raven.
The bottom line is Corey doesn't know it all.
I don't know it all, but I do remember that one company, and I wish I could remember their name, where they put out books and they would have on the cover, you know, like 142,019 of 250,000. They would say on the inside, we will never print more than 250,000 of each issue.
Wow.
It's like, you don't have to ever fucking worry about that because no one's buying this shit.
For the last one, I will be a little more fair.
Oh. Well, I don't
because,
care if you're...
Remember, these are books that I actually have sold, so I don't feel too bad. What do these five comics have in common? Guardians of Freedom, Captain America, He Lives, He Prowls, Spider-Man, Beware the Daredevil, Call Him Thor, and The History of Marvels.
This was one of Marvel's very cool experiments that I recently reread, where they published issues of comics that supposedly were the comics being published in the Marvel Universe. So if you lived in the Marvel Universe and you picked up a Spider-Man comic, it would be like this comic. If you picked up the Captain America comic, it was supposedly drawn by Steve Rogers, who drew the Captain America comic. It was a fun little experiment. It was one of those gimmicky things that comics used to do. It's like, okay, this month has 5 weeks in it. And we do 4 week, you know, our plan is we publish these books. The fifth week is spillover week, but they would have little events during those fifth week. So this was one of those events.
Yeah. And it started out, the idea was just a gem that occurred way back in one of the Fantastic Four books, where they revisited a couple times, where Marvel paid Fantastic Four a licensing fee to publish the True Adventures of Marvel Comics. And they did it, I believe they mentioned it way back in the original run when Stan Lee and Kirby were doing it. They revisited when in The Impossible Man crashed Marvel Comics.
Issue 176.
Because there was even a line where they saw these guys and said, what are you doing, Lee? Coming here to get the story right for a change? Because the bullpen was all aghast because Fantastic Four hadn't called him with this month's adventures. What are we going to do? Make it up? Gasp. No, we have to do it because no one's going to know the difference in an Impossible Man crash. Fun issue to look up and check it out. And if you want to...
George Perez at his best. Oh, my God. It was so much fun because he was drawing all the people who worked at Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was a big comic fan when this came out. It's like, oh, this is so great. Now I get to know what everybody looks like.
If you want, check out my eBay store, Crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z. Despite eBay trying to limit me, throttle me, kill the baby in the grave. Am I being a little melodramatic?
Yeah, it's a little...
Anyways, harsh. I'm posting things, so check it out.
And now that we're done with that, let's go to Freaking and Geeking. Joe, what you freaking on?
Every so often, life just kicks you in the gut. As you know, as I'm feverishly going through the tapes of my old radio shows back in college, looking for the commercials I need to make my next solo Joe, I got word that a friend of mine who I had been listening to on these hair tapes just passed away. William Bill Day passed away at 50, passed away suddenly. He was more my pal in college. I remember getting him into the college radio about the same time my partner Dave and I were getting out. He was IT, Institute of Technology. The fun thing about it was is when he got there, he actually really took to it. He had a good voice. He had a good sense of humor. He rose to, I think, what do they call it, a programming director? Whoever's in charge of the DJs?
Yep, program director.
As Dave and I wound down our morning show, what they did is they had 5 different morning shows, one each day of the week, and then on the weekends, they usually didn't start broadcasting till about 9 o'clock, so they didn't have a morning show. Dave and I had pretty much had a lock on the show almost the entire time we did it, so this was kind of a preview for everybody, as well as a kind of our last hurrah. So up on the board, as a DJ would sit down, he had a big sign from Bill saying, looking for a new morning show. If you're interested, please see Bill, cast your demo tape, whatever. And Dave and I looked at each other. That's probably because, you know, 2 out of the 3 morning shows are graduating, so we won't be here. So me, being the smartass I always am, wrote on it, Carl Marsh Fired, the name of our show, Carl Marsh Show. Carl Marsh Fired, which is like saying, okay, the guys who have been here for the last year are being kicked out by the new guy? Bill talked to me later on. He said, dude, did you write that on there? I go, yeah. Why? He goes, DJs are coming up to me and going, did you really fire them? And we're like, what'd you say? I said, yeah, I said I did. I said, okay, we'll just go along with it. No, we were graduated. We were leaving. It just happens. So it was really sad. I mean, again, I contacted Bill through Facebook maybe twice. I'm not even sure where he was. I don't know if he's in St. Paul. For a while there, he was out on the West Coast. But it's just one of those things, you know. People, if you haven't seen a friend or talked to a friend in a while, just reach out. You know, if it's Facebook, if it's email, if it's a phone call. 50's young. I'm 50. It was, like I said, it was just a kick. And now, as I continue to go through the tapes, it's kind of haunting because it's like looking at old pictures. But I'm going to be listening to his voice, remembering, you know, the fond days years ago.
And if I could jump in, one of the things that I've been saying for quite a while, and if you listen to PW Insider, by the way, to plug, I interviewed Mike Johnson from PW Insider last week. Dave Shearer is always saying, when people ask him how he is, he goes, "Great, I got up today." And if you would have asked me back when I was the lousy rat bastard, when I was Mr. Bad Example, you know, people would ask me, "How are you?" It's like, better than the alternative. We're not here that long. Every day is a great day because you got up. You woke up. You're here. You get to do stuff. Spend your time doing stuff you like with people you like. Life is, you're going to hear this everywhere, but it just, every day it hammers home. You know what? I got up today. It's a good day. Every day this side of the daisies is a good day. And like Joe said, take the time to connect with the people you care about. Let the people you love know you love them. Joe?
You know, I'm going to hate to do this, but Corey, what's got you freaking now?
Well, first, Joe.
Yes.
I love you.
Well, I love you, too, in a manly sort of way.
You're my heterosexual life partner. My first observation today, it's a little longer than most of these. I love the singer, songwriter, performer Mike Doty. Mike Doty was the lead singer of the band Soul Coughing. He has since gone out on his own. He's written a book called The Book of Drugs, where he talked about his time with Soul Coughing. He now owns all the Soul Coughing songs he wrote. I have seen him 15, 20 times. Have all of his albums, including the Minneapolis recording from First Avenue that is now out of print, that I bought from him at one of his First Avenue shows because he said, "I need to have enough money for gas to get to my next show." He is coming to town on Friday, Joe.
How much does he need? I'll see if I'll buy an album and get him to his next gig.
Here's the problem. He's at First Avenue, and tickets, if I were to buy them, you know, over the interwebs, are like $45 to $50. He's just the opening act for a band I don't care about.
Ah.
Which means he's only going to perform for 20 to 30 minutes. I'm not paying $45 to see him do 6, 7, 8 songs. And then, oh, there's a band. I know one of their hits, and just I don't like that song.
Hmm.
So it kind of annoys me when bands that I like or performers I like are opening acts for performers I don't like. Because I want to go see them, but I can't. The other thing, retailers are becoming very loud about falling sales.
And we were there first.
And
I guess that's nothing to brag about, is it?
Now, Joe, were you ever part of the retailer discussion boards that were kind of private that retailers used? I don't know if Diamond had them or where they were.
There was one that I was accepted to, but it was a pain in the butt to get to. And being that I had to use dial-up internet, I didn't really do it much.
But I guess on the message boards there, a lot of retailers are networking about the fact that DC's dropping like a rock, Marvel's not doing that well, and they're kind of, well, let's just say some of the retailers didn't listen to us as we've been talking for the past 6 years about diversify, diversify, diversify. But more and more, a lot of retailers are saying that their budget is going more and more toward Image, IDW, Boom, Dynamite, Fantagraphics. So, if you like your Marvel books, you better buy them. If you like your DC books, you better buy them. For one of the things that I've been hearing about, I can't tell you how many people are like, "Oh, I love the Lois and Clark comic that Dan Jurgens is doing. It's the old DC universe that I liked. Oh, I love that book. That's the kind of comics I like." Well, not enough of you are buying it because it's canceled with issue 7. And the reason it's canceled? Poor sales. The first of the all-new, all-different Marvel books to be canceled. Black Knight, issue 5, is the last one. they haven't even got all of the all new, all different Marvel stuff out, and they're already having to cancel books. So we're going to be looking at some shifting and changing in the comic market this year, and it's going to be very interesting times. I'm going to be interested to see if Star Wars holds up and Star Wars could keep Marvel afloat, but how this all new, all different Marvel does. The last thing I'm geeking on,
freaking.
Joe, you know,
freaking, we're freaking,
freaking,
no geeking,
freaking.
We'll geek later.
Okay. You know how I love me the reprints.
Yes.
And I especially love the big, thick reprints. One of the things Dark Horse is doing, they're reprinting the entire run of Marvel's Black and White magazine, Savage Sword of Conan. They're up to volume 21, which reprints stuff toward the end of the run. Stuff that I have not read. It's stuff from like 91, 92, 93. Oh my God, the art is terrible.
Was not expecting that.
Oh, look, here's this beautiful Ernie Chan issue where Ernie Chan would do all this beautiful detail and all this. He didn't use Zip-A-Tone. He would do the hand cross-hatching, and he would do hand shading. John Buscema, whenever John Buscema drew a black and white Conan, he would just pour himself into it because he loved drawing that stuff. But more and more, they would get these newer artists, many of whom aren't working in comics anymore. And you could tell they had no experience drawing in black and white because they were drawing very flat. They didn't use a lot of shadow. It's almost oversimplistic, which was what was in Marvel's color books at the time. But the black and white, you need to add a level of detail because you don't have the color to do the shading and to give nuance to the art. So it's, oh, this is just flat and it's bad and it's, some of it's just ugly to look at. And I can see why Savage Sword of Conan died looking at this stuff. I think there's one volume left. And then after that, they relaunched the Conan magazine. I forget what the name of it was, but they relaunched the Conan magazine that only lasted like 12 issues or so. But, oh, this is some shitty comics that I could see now why I didn't buy them at the time. Because I was looking, you know, because I like the Marvel magazines, and it was like, huh, I got really spotty about buying them. I wonder why that is. And now that I'm reading them all in this, it's like, oh, that's why. Yeah, that's why. Joe, what are you geeking on? What are you loving?
It's going to snow tomorrow. I got my box on
that?
Saturday.
Ah,
I got a lot of stuff to read. However, being that I like to talk about things that I read, and did you read Secret Wars number 9?
I have not had a chance yet. My weekend was supposed to be time.
I'm not looking
for
excuses now.
Joe, my weekend was supposed to be time for reading. You and Jin checked out last week. I can't tell you how many times I had to cut 10 minutes or so because you would ask a question and she would go, huh, what, I don't know. And then you'd repeat the question and she would give an answer and you would go, what was that? I was reading Facebook. I don't know what you said. Could you repeat that? It's like, oh, my God, people, you just want to make my life hell.
Well, now I know two things.
There's a new freaking.
I was going to say, now I know how Corey feels when I freak all over his geek. Although I know now what you feel like when you want to talk about a book and nobody's read it. Especially since we've been bitching about this one for months. Some bitch finally out and you don't want to read it. We'll talk about it next week.
Okay.
Can you guess what the first book, though, is that I read out of my box?
The Bill and Ted Archive.
Nope.
Oh,
Knights of the Dinner Table, number 227.
Oh, okay.
Doesn't matter what it is. I dig that sucker out. I also bring the back issue and the alter ego with me that happens to ship them up. I bring them to work with me and read them because I just absolutely love the adventures these guys are doing. So I always tend to read that one first. I did manage to read a couple other ones, and I kind of concentrated on the number ones. There were a lot this week. I only picked four to talk about. The first one is one I've been talking about, I've been looking forward to, Old Man Logan, number 1. And I don't know. I guess I'm not really giving a spoiler away. Somehow he survived the Secret Wars. He's been dumped into the present. And he's got to deal with it. And he deals with it the way Wolverine usually does.
By killing shit?
Well, you got to remember, he's from a future where there was an event where a bunch of superheroes killed everybody, which kept him... He basically wasn't Wolverine. He was just Logan the Farmer. He had a loving family. The rest of the world was run by villains. But then the Hulk gang murdered his wife, his son, his daughter, and that's when he popped his claws once more and took vengeance on the villains. That was the original Old Man Logan. He was in Secret Wars, and now he's in our time. And once he gets through his disorientation, he realizes, I need to change the world. I need to stop this from happening. And like you said, he's going after the villains that caused that his future. He also showed up in one of the X-Men books, which I thought was real interesting. And again, I'm not reading the X-Men, but I will kind of follow along with that to see what they're doing with it. So I give Old Man Logan a big thumbs up. Swamp Thing number one, Len Wein is back. Oh, I love this. See, this is the type of writing that a professional writer can do. Swamp Thing is, what's Swamp Thing's big thing he's been doing the last couple of years? What would they call that?
I have not read the new.
Well, it was even part of when Alan Moore and Rick Veitch were doing.
Rick Veitch.
Veitch was doing it. He was part of the Trees of Parliament. Well, just with a couple word balloons, Swamp Thing talks about why he's not hanging around with those guys anymore and allows you to stop asking the question, what about what happened before, and get on to, okay, what's happening now? It's a 6-issue series. Pick it up. Or if you're not going to pick it up, buy the book. But it's awesome. Okay, I'm going to read the first couple word balloons of the next book. Bring it, you brainless bastards. I'll bust you up like a pinata at a 4-year-old birthday party. Bubba, wait. Get back, babe. These things carry more diseases than a motel bed. Stop. Those ain't real zombies. Them folks is part of the convention's zombie walk. Yes, I read the first line of Bubba the Redneck Werewolf.
Oh, God.
Yes. My wife read it, too, and she lost 3 IQ points reading that. I read the whole thing, and I can now mumbo dog face to the banana patch. This is actually, it's fun because, A, it's a one-shot, and, B, they kind of take swipes at almost every horror property, sci-fi property, things. You got to kind of read carefully because, you know, something might pass you if not. It's a lot of jokes, a lot of weird things. I bought this basically to give to my brother-in-law because he's a redneck fan. Or is he a werewolf fan? Either way, he's going to love this one. So check it out. It's from Creature. Jaime Torres wrote it. Creature Entertainment. So it should be on your shelves of less discerning comic stores everywhere. The next and final book I'll talk about was called by my wife, Mind Blowing. Was called by my daughter, Dana, Spiritual Affinity. She said she had a spiritual affinity with this comic. Holly, my youngest daughter, said she likes the girls because they have vintage styles. Everybody felt to be cosplays. I'm talking about Mean Girls Club by Ryan Hersha, published through Nobrow. It introduces Pinky, Sweets, Blackie, McQuaalude, Wendy, and Wanda.
McQuaalude.
Together they form the Mean Girls Club, a menacing powerhouse of ruthless rebels. Like a cruel pink and black plague, these subversive sirens seek out the innocent and weak, feeding on pure fear, intoxication, vice, adrenaline. Witness a meeting of the Mean Girls Club, but don't expect to live and tell about it. Now, this was published by, if I can write it, let's see, a graphic story project designed to help talented young graphic novelists tell their stories. Copyright through Nobrow. If you go to www.nobrow.net, you can see what it's all about. But it sounds like they basically did this just to let somebody get their feet wet. Because Ryan, said it wrong before, Ryan Heshka, a self-taught artist and illustrator working primarily in traditional mediums. His work is frequently embellished with cuttings from vintage magazines, and he's exhibited across Europe and North America, and he's been published in Blab. So, a cute little book I picked up. Obviously, I just saw it in previews and thought it was really cool. And again, if you want to check it out, www.nobrow.net. Probably give a copy to Jen, because this is the type of thing she might want to be published by. You know, just a quickie comic that gets your style out there to the world and lets people try it. As soon as this here podcast's over, I'm going upstairs to watch episode 3 of X-Files. That's all I'm geeking on. Corey, what are you geeking on? What's got you happy?
I often talk about my love of comics history, and lately Facebook has been feeding that. I'm a crack addict, and they cannot get the drugs in me fast enough.
Can I interrupt momentarily?
Sure.
Speaking of that, I just got a link of the Crusader series comics online, all of them. It's in late 70s, Jack Chick took a stab at publishing a four-color comic that was like...
Yes.
Yes. And I got a
yes
to all of them. Oh,
it is batshit insane.
Just beautiful. As a matter of fact, I will post it up on our crazy comic book site for all to enjoy.
And do you know why he quit doing it? Not because it wasn't making money. Who owns the superhero team named the Crusaders?
Oh, Archie.
One of the most litigious publishing companies in the world, Archie Comics, sent a cease and desist letter. Archie was so litigious that they went after EC Comics repeatedly for Archie parodies. To the point where there are some people who say that certain phrases and words were put into the comics code by the publisher of Archie because he wanted to put Bill Gaines out of business.
Hmm.
That's why horror, terror, and weird were not allowed to be titles of comics, according to this story. But that's not what I'm geeking on. There, on the comic historian group, someone asked about Atlas Comics, Atlas Seaboard. And for those of you who don't know, give a little history here. In the late 60s, Martin Goodman, who founded Marvel... Marvel was one of the things he published. He also published pulp magazines. He published what were known as men's sweat magazines, which were kind of stories. The stories were all He-Man beating up lions and tigers and sharks and stuff. And pictures of ladies in their underwear and then later no underwear. And cheap paperback books. But he sold the comics to Candace Industries in the late 60s, and part of the deal was that he would kind of stay on as publisher for a while. And then when they would reach a point in the contract, he believed that when he was removed as publisher, as part of the contract, they would make his son, Chip, publisher of Marvel Comics. The thing was, the minute they were able to get rid of Martin Goodman, they told Chip, "You no longer work here." And Stan was put in charge of being the publisher of Marvel Comics, which is when Roy Thomas ascended to editor-in-chief. Martin Goodman did not take that well, as you can imagine. And he decided he would do what he did in the 40s and 50s. He was going to put Marvel out of business by starting a new comic company and flooding the market. So he started Atlas Comics, which also was known as Atlas Seaboard, because much like all of Goodman's other stuff, the company had a bunch of different shell companies for, you know, hiding money for tax purposes. And he offered higher rates than both Marvel and DC in order to bring in the talent that he felt would sell the books. He also offered, he was the first publisher to say, "We will give you your original art back." and someone was talking about Atlas Seaboard on this discussion list, many of the people on Facebook who are on that list worked at Atlas at the time. So they have been telling their stories of what happened and how, why they left. Because if you read the Atlas comics, I have a complete run of them now, except the romance books, which are fucking impossible to find. You'll see that there would be two issues, and then if a third issue came out, it was usually a massive change from the first two. And if a fourth issue came out and they didn't have a massive change, then they would change creative teams and themes and the whole... It was like, okay, it's been two issues, it's not selling, we'll reboot. And they talked about how they were promised things and then they weren't delivered. Some of the characters from Atlas have showed up over at Marvel because the creators felt that they owned the characters, and when they brought them over to Marvel, Atlas was gone, so they didn't say anything. So Devil Slayer, a Marvel character now, was an Atlas character. Howard Chaykin brought over his character Scorpion, but he changed the name and some of the details, and it became Dominic Fortune, that sort of thing. But I'm here reading about all of this behind-the-scenes stuff and how the editor was just... He makes Jim Shooter look like the kindest, gentlest man in comics. And how it was just chaos. And I could read this shit all day. I love this kind of stuff. They then get into the comic distribution end, which we talked about, where even into the 70s, and I'd heard this from Martin Greep, who owned Cap City, even into the 70s in Chicago, the trucks that would deliver magazines and comics had bulletproof glass because it was run by the mob, and they were there were still, oh, you're delivering magazines to where we have a contract, someone would show up with a gun and try to shoot them. Martin Greep talked about how when he started Cap Cities, he actually had to meet with some unsavory people because another small comic distributor tried to distribute comics to comic shops in Chicago, and when they at one point all of their trucks caught on fire. What a coincidence. All of their trucks caught on fire the same night. So I'm just reveling in this stuff. There's this treasure trove of information that used to be on the Yahoo groups lists and things like that. So me as an amateur historian, I'm just rolling around and enjoying this. The one comic I did read, Joe, I actually have mentioned already.
Ooh.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, The Archive. This was a comic based on the movies that I think I saw the first one and thought it was okay, and I never did watch the second one. But Marvel published 12 issues of a comic based on that by Evan Dorkin. And it is Evan Dorkin drawing for Marvel. So it's the Evan Dorkin insanity, but he had an editor on him to tamp it down enough so that the stories make sense and it's not the same joke over and over. It's Evan Dorkin being inked by Marie Severin, Evan Dorkin being inked by Stephen DeStefano. This is beautiful, beautiful art. It's very funny. The book is cheap. Go buy the damn thing. Even if you don't like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, even if you watched the movie and went, this is stupid, you're going to love this comic. It's Evan Dorkin doing a story about two 90s slackers traveling through time. What more do you want? And then the last thing I am geeking on, I'll make it two.
Oh.
I have not read the latest issue of Alter Ego yet, but the latest issue of Alter Ego is a tribute to Jim Shooter. And if you would have told me in 1980, 81, 82, 83, around that time, that Roy Thomas would publish a magazine where he talks about how great Jim Shooter is, I would have kneecapped you.
Yep.
Because Roy Thomas had such active hatred for Jim Shooter after Shooter screwed him over with contract negotiations. And I just keep looking at that cover going, this is weird. this is really
I weird. Actually read Tony Isabella brings up a couple points that he does not agree with everything that Jim said. He says,
what a shock.
I know. Well, a lot of it has to do with Saul. Oh, what was his name? Stanley's right-hand man in the Sixth.
Saul Brodsky, yeah. Who we talked about a little earlier tonight.
Yeah, he said that some of the things Jim said weren't true.
What a shock.
But then again, you know, you write history the way you perceive it, which is kind of interesting because I'm reading the alter ego that is a tribute to Saul. So I'm still a ways behind on a few of them.
And as I've talked before, Jim Shooter, we had that at the convention where he talked to us. He got drunk and told Marvel stories till 4 in the morning. He started a blog years ago and eventually quit it because more and more of the creators from the time were showing up and going, Jim, that's not true. Jim, this didn't happen. You're coloring history. This is what you always do. You always change history to make yourself look like a hero. And he just quit blogging.
Which is really too bad because I was really digging the blog.
Yeah. But the other issue that I got was Back Issue finally did their Giant Size Marvel issue. And I talked about those when we did our What Comics Did You Read When You Were Sick. These Giant Size Marvels were the books that I read when I broke my jaw. And just reading about the creators behind the scenes and how they came about and how they were going to do 35-cent comics. And then, no, we're going to do 60-cent comics, they'll be 100 pages. Oh, wait, no, we can't afford that, so we'll do 50-cent comics that are 68 pages. All of that stuff behind the scenes. Back Issue and Alter Ego are just, I hope they go on forever. Because it's all the stuff that I like. It's all the comic book history. It's interviews with the people who were there. And one of the things I really enjoy is that they're very honest about, I don't remember why we did that. There had to be a reason, but I don't remember why.
Yeah.
Even Tony Isabella talking about stuff was like, yeah, I wish I could I don't even remember writing that story. And I know at the time it was probably, you have to get this done by tomorrow morning, and I would just stay up all night and do it. Marvel in the 70s sounds like it was pure chaos.
Yeah. Even the little I've read about it, it's amazing some of the craziest comics came out at that time, but then again, I think because of that chaos, people were allowed to do it. I mean, Howard the Duck, Jim Starlin working Warlock, just Man-Thing. I mean,
well, and they
were
told by
Strange.
They were told by ownership, we want this many books out on the shelf. It wasn't, we want, you know, this. It was, we want 50 books out. Okay, this month we want 64 comics published. To where with a lot of the reprints, they were like, what do we have? What do we have that we can put in today? Well, kids, believe it or not, you've listened to us blather on about funny books for an hour and a half.
And next week, we can find out if Corey survived going to work during the Tuesday blizzard. Or will it be an unexpected episode of Solo Joe?
And as we say every week, the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic that you like the most, Joe.
There is a cult of ignorance in the United States, and there has always been. The strain of anti-intellectualism has been a constant thread winding its way through our political and cultural life, nurtured by the false notion that democracy means that my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge. Isaac Asimov. Corey, hit my music.
Hey, yo. Can somebody call my mama? It's about to get funky up in here.